Welcome to the Making Sense Podcast. This is Sam Harris. Today I'm speaking with my friend Bill Maher about the state of our world. Bill probably needs no introduction. He is the host of Real Time on HBO, and he has his own podcast, Club Random. Before Real Time, which he's hosted for the last 21 years, Bill created and hosted Politically Incorrect on ABC. And he's the author of a new book, What This Comedian Said Will Shock You, which we discuss at the beginning of this conversation. Then we turn to the aftermath of October 7th, the cowardice and confusion of many celebrities, gender apartheid, the failures of the Biden campaign, Bill's relationship to his audience, the differences between the left and right politically, Megyn Kelly, loss of confidence in the media, our expectations for the 2024 election, the security concerns of some old-school Republicans, the prospect of a second Trump term, totalitarian regimes and how they fall, functioning under medical uncertainty, Bill's plan to stop doing stand-up, maybe, his experience of fame, Jerry Seinfeld, and other topics. Anyway, this was fun. And now I bring you Bill Maher.
All right, let's just hit the ground running.
Well,
well, I can edit, so you can't. You can't.
I know, but
possibly...
I don't want you to have to. I'm just getting soda, but okay. I just don't want you to have to hear that
the clatter
on your beautiful podcast. Okay,
what are you drinking, Bill Maher?
This is just a little roofie for you, so things go well after the show. No, this is something. It's like it replaces diet soda. It's this healthiest version.
Huh, what is it?
He just poured into sparkling water. It's some chemist made it, and he's convinced me it's real.
Right.
And I think
but
it's
is it stevia or what's the
there's a little in there, yeah. Uh-huh. But I was drinking stevia soda, but he says there's a lot of chemicals still in there.
Right, right.
You know, it's always playing the odds.
Well, you seem to be winning so far.
Well, you know, let's not even go there.
No, we're going to go there. We got to talk about, well, first, I will remind, I will have introduced you properly, obviously, in the housekeeping, but I will remind people that you have a new book, What This Comedian Said Will Shock You, which is really fantastic because, I'm listening to it as an audiobook and you read the audio and it's based on your, 20 years of your end of show editorials, which that must have been fun to actually go back and look at how times have changed.
No, it was grueling, actually. Well, because... I'm not a person who does well watching myself. I never watch my own show. I should. Mm-hmm. It would be much more professional to look at yourself. But I figured, well, I've been on 31 years. Maybe it would make it worse. You know, maybe I would see something and get self-conscious and it seems to be working. And,
but you didn't go back and watch. You must have just looked at the transcripts.
Of course. And look, those are my babies. Mm. I mean, that's what I work hardest on the show. It's what I loved doing the most. I would give up anything else in show business before I gave up that. And then, look, they are good. I mean, but look, over 20 years, they're not all going to be 100 out of 100, and some stuff ages badly. Not terribly badly, not like I have very different political opinions. That was part of why I did this, to see if I did. But just they're stale. You know, they're making fun of John Boehner. Right, yeah, it's not funny anymore, and half the country doesn't know who I'm talking about. So there was a lot of work bringing them up to date, but it was a labor of love, and people have been telling me for a very long time I should do this. You know, that this would make a good book.
Well, you took the time to write them in the first place, so it's really, I mean, they're very well-crafted little essays. So
Yeah, and they're funny. I mean, everyone who reads this says, I'm LOLing on every page, which is rare for a book, I think. But as I read over the book itself, after I finished it, I was like, yeah, people. And of course, they were originally done as editorials on a television show where I was getting big LOLs.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I noticed in listening to it as an audiobook, because the original form was for you to read it in front of an audience. And I'm hearing where all the laughs would be and but there's no audience in the audiobook. There's no laugh track in the audiobook, which, I mean, you could, had you sweetened it, you would have had to put in endless pauses because the velocity of the laughs is like, it's like every 4 seconds, there's a button, and it's really,
Yeah, as long, and my prime directive in doing these, while there was a few, One was, don't be earnest. I talk about that in the introduction. Don't be earnest, which to me is when commentators talk about a subject as if it's more important to them personally than the starving people in Sudan. You know what I'm talking about? Kind of. And also, put in the laughs. Don't, it just can't just be, and you, sir, are bad. You got to leaven it. And as long as the laughs are always in service of the point and they don't go too far away, then it works for me. And that's always what I followed. And I think, yeah, I think you see it reflected in the book.
So we're talking on the, I would call it a set. It's not quite a set. This is actually your guest house bunker. But we're on your Club Random set.
Yes, thank you for coming over. I mean,
it's great. Well, it's super easy to do it this way. As you know, I do all my podcasts remotely. But
must be nice to have a little human contact, huh, Sam?
It is good,
Those of us like myself who listen to you religiously, everyone, we do see you kind of as the voice of God. And I know you do that in your meditation even more. But like that voice, I must say, I'm very flattered to be here because, like I say, I listen every week and it's almost always some egghead like you with advanced college degrees. I feel like I'm really slumming up your podcast as a mere Bachelor of Arts degree and a comedian. And you know,
as we have seen, the eggheads are being miseducated at this point. The new batch of eggheads are going to be quite something.
Not the ones you have on, though. They're always good people.
Yeah.
Except that Rory guy.
Oh, that was interesting. Yeah. Well, he is an incredibly impressive person, but he's quite miseducated on this particular point.
Really?
It's really, well.
Isn't that a conundrum in life that we all think about all the time? How can someone be so smart on one thing and not get it so much on another? And they're thinking about us the same way about certain issues.
Yeah, well, we should talk about this because a lot of this relates of late to what's happened post October 7th. And just we see this great fracturing of public opinion. But strangely, I've noticed that, you know, many people in your line of work, you know, people in Hollywood, even some very famous people who agree with us about how the moral landscape looks, are terrified to say anything. And the people on the other side are not terrified. There are A-list celebrities who are not terrified to be mistaken for Hamas supporters. But anyone defending Israel.
I know.
But can you explain, like, how is it if the Jews control Hollywood? How is it that it is so terrifying to state the obvious? There's a difference between a death cult and a group of people, however ineptly it's attempting to defend itself against a death cult.
Well, I will answer your question, but did I interrupt your introduction? Did we never get to where you were? Did I cut you off for something? Housekeeping?
I'll do a separate housekeeping, but if people notice that the acoustics are different here, we're in your house. I'm not in my studio. So, yeah.
I see
that's
you're on the lam from the people who love Gaza. Okay. Well, I mean, there's so much to this answer. As I think we both agree, the mouth of the river is what I've always called it, of the insanity that flows down from the left side of the spectrum is colleges, universities. Somehow they became huge asshole factories. And, they teach, I guess, postmodernism. Have you ever read that book? Or maybe you had the authors on called Cynical Theories?
Yeah, I know.
You're aware of it?
It's James Lindsay and yes. Howard Pluckrose, yeah.
Have you read it? Do you have an opinion of it? It's sort of, if people don't know, it's sort of a dissection of where this kind of crazy, what we think of, and I think we're, you know, old school liberals, basically, but what we think of as the nuttiness on the left.
Yeah.
The origins of it. And it goes, it's very detailed and arcane. And I don't think we can reproduce it here, but it basically started in the 70s in France, ideas about postmodernism that found their way into American universities. And just the term postmodernism, I always felt was crazy because don't you want to be modern? What's after modern?
Yeah, right.
Nutty. Yeah. That's what's
how
after
much better does it get after modern?
But this sort of encapsulates the answer to your question is, how could the people who control Hollywood be on the side that's against the Jews? Because everything, once you go past modern, you're sort of back at your own ass again.
Right.
With your head up it.
Yeah. It's funny, you unwittingly, in mentioning that particular book, you have encapsulated really the totality of our problem at the moment, because one of the authors of that book, James Lindsay, kind of spiraled off into Trumpistan and Conspiristan.
Oh.
And got very, very weird. And, you know, James, I hear your pain, but he got very, very weird. Helen, his co-author, did not. But it's not to say they're wrong about what they wrote in that book at all. It's just that once you get sufficiently entranced by the horror on the left or the horror on the right, you get sort of radicalized or self-radicalized or radicalized by your audience. And you just, very few of us have been able to keep both extremes in view and in proportion. I mean, they're not that, I mean, this is something you point out in your book. At equal extremes from reason, they're equally extreme. They're still very different. And we have to respond to them differently.
Yes, I did not know that about Mr. Lindsay. And again, this is the issue that I'm always dealing with, and I think quite a few of us are. How do you get your mind around that problem of this person seems so smart on these things, and we can sit and talk for an hour, and I will talk to anybody here. I've talked to the far sides, and always came away friendly with everybody. Because we're not dwelling on the politics. And when it gets to that moment where it's a political, I mean, I had the, who was the guy? Dana White.
Right.
You know, he's far right. He's a Trumper. We had a great time. You just have to. There's no other way this country can heal. You have to get over that thing in your head that says, oh, well, you know, 4 out of 5 of these compartments didn't flood, but the fifth one, that can't be enough to sink the ship.
Right.
You know, in the Titanic, there was 9 compartments. The guy, Victor Garber, comes out and says, only 4 of them had flooded. We'd be fine. But the 5th one did, and now we're going down. And I feel like that's our minds. It's compartments. And a couple of them and almost everybody will be flooded. I feel like you and I and Andrew Sullivan and, you know, Barry Weiss and this, there is a group of us. But I do feel like we're sort of standing like this, you know, with our backs to each other, because there's only few of us, and the hordes are coming from all around us, from both sides. So we have to like get into that phalanx of the Roman soldiers.
Yeah, that's a good image. Yeah. So back to Hollywood for a moment. Why is it that these celebrities are terrified to state the obvious in the aftermath of October 7th, and so many are not terrified to get on what is quite obviously the wrong side of this? I mean, to be clear, there are people who signed letters castigating Israel in the immediate aftermath of October 7th before Israel had done anything in response. Like, how is it that that was moral high ground that they thought they could stake out? And we literally have Jewish celebrities who I won't name, who won't go on your podcast or my podcast or Rogan's podcast and talk about anything here because they're afraid they'll never work in this town again.
Well, the short answer is celebrities are stupid. No, I exaggerate slightly.
Well, actually, let me just add to that. Now, you're not quite exaggerating because a Harris poll just came out, a Harvard Harris poll came out, and they're actually completely out of touch with public opinion in the country. 75% of Americans want the IDF to go into Rafah. 75%.
Sam, let me say this in a nicer way. And I do mean this in more sincerely than my insulting comment. People in the arts perceive truth differently. They get at truth differently, poetically, metaphorically. They're not stupid in general. There are some, yes. But they just, it's not an information-based talent that they have. It's emotional. It's about feeling. That's why they're so big on your truth and, you know, your felt truth, whatever phrases they're using for just, this is what I want to believe, so I'm going to. The world is not a completely rational place. I think you and I think we can get at truth better through rationality, but it's just not how the people in the arts, they're more emotionally linked. That's what works for them with the audience. It's just who they are. And for many reasons, that's why we love them more. I mean, we idolize them and adore them to the point of swelling their heads where they go crazy because they're so adored. That happens a lot in show business. We don't have that effect on people, you and I, but we're more, I think, sane about perceiving truth. So they don't know the history of the Middle East. All they know is, well, the kids are doing it, so it must be hip, so you don't want to lose the young audience. So let's just get with them. They didn't do enough research to realize that it's not even most kids, right. but it's the ones who are on the news and it gets on their phone. And of course, there's also tremendous peer pressure out here. I mean, the people who are the far, far leftist, I mean, they really control the debate. You do not want to get on their wrong side. They control the media. They control the gossip. So you better be exact, like when you had we had the strike last year. You better be exactly on that page and not have any questions about the strike. And I had questions. Many people did, but very afraid to speak. It's not that different with political issues either, I think. You better get in line and believe that and parrot that, or else you are ostracized in this town. And, you know, that certainly has happened to actual conservatives, and they complained about it, and I don't blame them for complaining about it. Bruce Willis complained about it. People who were just Republican, just believed in smaller government and the old Republican stuff, which is not against the law and is sometimes correct, but it got to the point where it was people like you and me,
right?
Who aren't even Barry Weiss. I mean, we're not even, we don't think of ourselves as conservatives, and we're not. We name almost any liberal issue, and we're like, yes, of course, we were there a long time ago. We were there on, you know, racism and gay rights and pod, whatever it is.
No, I'm left on every issue, except I'm right of John Bolton on jihadism. That's the one thing.
Me too. Yeah. That's the ultimate blind spot for them because, again, they don't know things. So it's really as simple as, well, the kids are doing it. And also, it's about brown people and white people because they think Israelis are all white, which they're, of course, not. But to them, it's the browner, poorer people and the whiter, richer people. And I think we know who the bad guy in this story is. You know, it's really that simple. They really can only perceive things simply, like black and white is the perfect metaphor for them. And that's why, you know, people of color all over the world can get away with anything. I mean, North Korea starves its people. You know, China puts the Uyghurs in concentration camps. A couple of African countries talk openly these days about marching gays into stadiums and killing them for the crime of being gay. I mean, it's just comical, the lengths that they will go to not see crimes if they're not committed by colonizers or, you know, the patriarchy.
But it's even the UN. It's like Amal Clooney bringing an arrest warrant against Netanyahu and Sinwar as though they're equivalent characters.
Yes. I mean, I was on The View this week.
Oh, I didn't see that appearance. So how'd
really,
that go for
Sam, you missed The View that day? Well, were you sick?
No, in anticipation of this conversation, I've been following a little bit of your press. I watched you with Megyn Kelly. I watched you in a few places. I saw you almost fight with her a little bit.
Absolutely.
So what happened on The View?
Well, you know, first of all, I was very glad to be there. I hadn't been there in a long time. I'm friends, really good friends with Joy and Whoopi for years. The other ones I did not know. They were new to the show, but, you know, it's a show that makes news and it's well watched and well received and it's in the zeitgeist. So I really wanted to go there and reconnect with my friends. And also, look, I'm not going to lie, I they walked right into the feminist trap because, you know, they started in on, I forget how it's up, but Gaza. Again, you're right. You're always the bad guy if you're the defending Israel because you're not upset about the women and children being killed. Yes, I am very upset about it. I don't think that's good either, women and children being killed anywhere in the world. My question to them is always, first, do you think Hamas should be destroyed? And people almost always say yes. I don't know how much they really know about Hamas, but I think they kind of get that it is a...
They get it as a trap.
I'm not to the trap part yet.
Yeah, okay.
So first I lay out the war thing, which is, yes, it's a fascist dictatorship and it's a terrorist army.
Right.
Both those things describe Hamas. And they are despised by their own people. And they have avowed to wipe out Israel many times and have tried many times and quite openly say they will keep trying to do that. Does that group need to be destroyed? And they say, yes. Then we're just talking about how to do it.
Yeah.
And you're saying you know better than... I don't know if they're using too many bombs. And you don't either, whoever I'm talking to. You just don't.
Right.
What I do know is that the history of Israel, I trust them more than any other nation to at least try. to be humane. They've had remarkable patience.
Well, just for, even if they were a nation of psychopaths, for pure self-interest, right, given what happens to them on the world stage every time they kill kids, it's in their interest to be more scrupulous than any other fighting force to minimize collateral damage. There's just no upside for them as a nation to be indiscriminate with their bombs. So the fact that, you know, it's, they have this additional problem is that they're fighting a terrorist army that is using its own civilian population as human shields.
Yes. That's a,
that has,
I've heard you speak eloquently on that, the moral equivalence.
Yeah.
Ridiculous, yeah, part of that scenario. Okay, so, but this wasn't my, yeah, the feminist trap was, yeah, all right, here you are defending, and I'm the bad guy because I'm for Israel and you're for the Palestinians. And then I just always say, if you had to live in Gaza for even one day, and I don't mean during the war, of course, that's a nightmare, but just under normal Gaza, you would run screaming and begging to live in Tel Aviv, in a,
right,
where people share the values that, that you prize. And if you're looking for a cause, how about women? Because this is a show hosted by women, and mostly women are in the audience.
Yeah, yeah.
So now you're in my feminist state. You can't argue with this.
This is the final jiu-jitsu move.
But all you have to do is describe, like in most Muslim majority countries, including certainly Gaza, like the what women go through for these people who are so obsessed with this word apartheid and thinking that Israel is an apartheid state, which it is not. There's a real apartheid in the world, a gender apartheid. I mean, where one half of the population, not black and white, just male and female, is treated completely different, with no equal rights in speech or how you can dress or reproductive rights or education opportunities, certainly freedom from sexual violence and sexual harassment. I mean, I could go down the list. I guess I did to some degree. That isn't the issue of the day. That's going to be my next editorial.
Yeah.
Just throw, like, I know you're looking for a cause, kids, which is great. I think that's a great impulse. How about this one? Because it's really big.
The moral confusion is so complete, however, because the hijab became the symbol of female empowerment for the Women's March. You have a Shepherd Fairey poster of a woman, a gorgeous woman in a hijab, just excluding the male gaze, you know, with this religious symbol, which is, in fact, the mechanism of enshrining this gender apartheid in Muslim majority countries. And you have women who are struggling to get out from under that. And the moment they show their hair in Iran, they're thrown in prison and raped and tortured and killed sometimes.
I mean, again, the image I have of you sticking your head out so far, thinking you're so progressive, but actually it being back around under your ass.
Up your own ass, yeah.
Is, again, another example.
Yeah. All right, so back to you and what you're up to here. What how do you think of your own audience at this point? I mean, you've got two very different gigs. You're just talking on both platforms, but you have your HBO show and you've got Club Random. Obviously they couldn't be more different in terms of just the execution. I mean, it's just this. Right. You must love doing this, right?
I love them both, and that's why. I mean, this moment in my life is great because I feel like it is more complete with Club Random because now these are the two sides of me. I mean, suit and tie, and certainly not stodgy. I mean, I think people see Real Time as a pretty hip show that's pretty freewheeling. I was shocked when they let me put it on CNN. I mean, when they asked me to, and I said, well, what about all the language and the, we don't care.
So are they airing? I haven't actually watched it on CNN. Are they airing all full episodes?
HBO.
It's the exact same cut?
No, they had to. We cut out one segment because they have to put in commercials.
Right.
But they don't edit it, which I was shocked.
That is shocking.
Now you can say fuck on CNN and nobody cares.
Is that one good thing that Trump did to the universe?
Yeah. But it is amazing the way that happens sometimes where you don't realize where the river has flowed to until something indicates, and then you go, oh, wow, you can say fuck on CNN and nobody cares. That's where the country is.
Right.
That is different from even 10 years ago, certainly 20. And when I first did The Tonight Show, you couldn't say ass on TV. So we've come a long way, baby. But I love this because it's exactly who I am when I'm off working and we're just sitting around and I'm always stoned for it, that makes a big difference. And there's no agenda. My show, I have an agenda. I look at that show real time as a show that catches people up on the news who don't have time to follow it every day. Or maybe they do and they just like an analysis of it. There's both sides of that. But a lot of people watch it to get the news.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like, oh, this is what happened this week. So I have a clear agenda and I work many, many hours to make it just right. It's like football players versus baseball. Once a week, you really want to get it right.
Right.
But this is just, you know, it can be anything. And most of the people here are not political people. And that's great because I don't always want to talk about politics. It's a bit of a busman's holiday for me.
Yeah. I think real time got better when you went to just two people on the panel.
Totally.
It was too crowded.
Too crowded. Yeah. Could not agree more.
I forgot what forced that. Did it just happen by accident? Okay, it was the pandemic.
Uh-huh. Pandemic did us a lot of good. Got us a better audience also because we had to socially distance. And so the crowd was like only a third of the size and they were awesome. And I was like, why don't we just keep, I'd rather have these people. And, you know, we just, for a while there was people who, I don't know why they persisted in coming to a show they must have known was going to be somewhat upsetting to them or to me, because they were a very far left woke crowd. And I've never been there. But there was years when I was fighting with my own audience, you know, saying stuff that was like perceived in any way as not being towing the woke line. And I was, you know, I have pictures on my wall of me doing this, giving the finger to the crowd, and I would be, you know, and a lot of people said they liked that. It was kind of interesting. And I could see how that is interesting. It's certainly not what you see in other talk shows, the talk show host saying, fuck you to your own audience. But they would just annoy me with their lack of open-mindedness.
Yeah. You have some of these great moments where you, sometimes you'll tell a joke and it won't land. And you'll look with contempt at your audience, like, okay, I'll wait for the laugh. Like, you're going to fucking laugh at that.
Yeah. But now the audience has been awesome. Yeah. And they're my people. They're our people. They laugh at both sides. And they don't hold it against you. They definitely cheer stuff that's anti-Trump and stuff. I think they're where we are, basically, which is, you know, give us back old school Republicans. Give us back a party that we might even consider voting for, not these nuts, and get rid of the far woke nonsense on the left. By the way, on The View, they were saying I should not use the word woke, and I was wondering, I was going to ask you about this. It is a word that triggers people, and it is a word that, like a lot of people, including a lot of African-American people, I understand, it has a special meaning of its original meaning, which I think we all think was great, to be alert to injustice.
Right.
And then it migrated to a very different place, much the way the word violence, for example, has migrated. It used to mean, oh, I know what violence is. It's physical and it hurts. And now it's just like anything I don't like.
Yeah.
And
except for clitorectomies and suicide bombing. That's not violence. That's just this voice of the oppressed.
Right. But so I would love to find some other word and get people to use it.
I'm sort of out of touch with the original roots of it. I mean, when I started hearing woke everywhere, it was already contaminated with a fair amount of moral confusion.
And no, so it was an old school term from decades ago.
Yeah.
And it was certainly understandable why black folks in this country would need to, for their own survival, stay woke. And It's a shame because it is a great word with a great history. But yeah, I mean, it was a hostile takeover.
So in thinking about your audience, the point you're making about going against the audience and that not being conventional, that's especially true out in my world. I mean, many of us talk about a phenomenon that we call audience capture, where, you know, if you have a podcast, and it's really all of alternative media, so podcasts or newsletters, it relates to what we talked about earlier, where people get radicalized by their own audience because they begin to cater to the signal in their audience that is driving clicks or driving subscription. You know, my audience wants to hear just more and more about how Trump is awful. And then you just see how that person or that channel becomes, on the one hand, boring, but not to the fanatics, but also just less than scrupulous in how they call balls and strikes because they're just now they're on team whatever it is.
Well, I think the best example of that is certain people have gone over to MSNBC.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, who yeah. were, well, like Nicole Wallace. And I like her very much. Done my show and I see her. I think she's great. She's very pro and very smart. But she was hired, I think, as I'm sure she was. She was a Bush spokesperson. So she was hired as the conservative. But I think this is probably when Trump was, or maybe it was before that. But anyway, it was like okay to have a conservative if they were like anti-Trump. I mean, Brett Stevens also said, I think, or indicated to me once that, you know, he's invited on that network, but usually it's only limited to a certain
never Trumpers.
Yeah, a certain area that is not going to upset the MSNBC audience. Mm-hmm. Right. Like you have a conservative on, but he's agreeing with us on the doctrine that we've all agreed on.
Yeah.
Now, and a lot of that doctrine I agree with too. It's just, I just object to like forcing it. But anyway, so like I think somebody like that, they go over to MSNBC as a guest, you know, on the show a lot, and they do well. But again, they were a conservative. They were a Bush administration person. Then they get hired, you know, now you're there every day. The only mm-hmm. people you talk to. And slowly you go right from just a conservative, but a never Trumper to a full on liberal. That's a little creepy to me.
I've noticed this much more in the other direction. You have people just like us, or they used to be just like us, who began to react to the craziness on the left. And there's something that I think, you tell me if it's true for you, there's something more annoying about the extremism on the left than on the right.
Viscerally, and, yes. The right is more intellectual. I know in my mind, the right is way more worse. Dangerous.
Yes.
But you're right.
But it's not nearly as annoying.
Yeah. It's more obnoxious.
Yeah.
It's first of all, it's embarrassing because it's sort of our team, more than my team for sure, and I think yours. So it's like, you're embarrassing us on that, our team.
Well, you're also destroying institutions that I really care about.
Right.
I don't care about Liberty University. Right. It was already destroyed. But the New York Times.
And the ACLU.
And Harvard. And like I care about these institutions.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So do you think of your audience as just a unified population? I mean, the audience for Club Random is the same as the show? Or
no. It's all over the map. Mm-hmm. And stand-up. I mean, it's good in the sense that it's a very wide range. It's some younger, middle, I mean, Gen X, a lot of those, but millennials too. And the TV show gets a younger number, you know, median number than the late night shows. And it's politically all over the map too. Not, of course, a lot of woke anymore. I think I lost that audience. Mm-hmm. I think they walked out the door and it's okay. The super far left, I'm not, the people who are giving purity tests. Right. I am not the one to be passing a purity test, and that's okay. I don't miss them, and I replace them with, I think, many more people in the middle.
Right.
And also, I definitely, yes, it's true, hear from more conservatives, but never really the hard right asshole conservatives. It's more like the guys on the golf course.
Right.
Who used to think I was a huge liberal asshole, and now think, oh, okay, at least he has the guts to call out where the left went crazy. And maybe they think they, in their mind, maybe they think they saw the crazy on the left before I did.
Mm.
I would contend, and one reason I went through all those editorials is to find out if, actually, no, the left did get crazier. I don't think I missed something in, in 2012 under no Obama. Question. I think he was pretty sane, and I don't think Gen Z had come along yet. And I don't think you could point to a lot of specific things that we're not where they are today, including, of course, marching with terrorists, stuff right. like that.
So I think you and I had a pretty similar experience over the last 10 years in purging our audience of the two extremes, discovering
right.
that the far left hated us suddenly because we weren't woke, and then also discovering that because we had made sense when aimed left, and certainly made sense on, you know, the collision between Western culture and jihadism, all that we had a lot of far right proto-Trumpist fans who suddenly were blindsided by the fact that we didn't recognize Trump's brilliance.
Exactly. So, I've had that, yes, yeah. I've had to face that disappointment in people's eyes also. And that's, again, what I mean about how can you think this, and not this?
Right.
And we just have to, you know, get past that, because I would love to know what your prediction is for, let's say, the month of January 2025. Yeah. How do you see that month? I mean, I have a birthday that month, happens to be inauguration day.
It could be a big month. It could be, we might be having your birthday in a bunker somewhere.
Luckily, we have one.
Yeah. I mean, it is amazing that we're here and that the Democratic Party had years to watch this slow-moving catastrophe.
Right.
And they couldn't figure out how to...
Still can't.
...put anyone else in position other than...
Still can't.
...than Biden. Who appears to be... I mean, this is... It's hard to know because you don't see that much of him, but it wouldn't be surprising if week by week, certainly month by month, he's just getting obviously worse as a candidate.
That's happening now.
Yeah, no, I know. I mean, I feel like I'm hearing rumors that it's just, well, they're shielding him from the cameras.
It's only going one way.
Yeah, no, it's not. There's no way he's going to get more pep in his step.
No, it's a shame. You know, politically, he's a disaster. Policy-wise, not a disaster at all.
No, although the way in which he's tried to split the difference on Israel has been quite stupid politically.
But it could have been worse.
Yeah, it could have been. It certainly could have. In the beginning, he was great, and then he
biggest failure to me, when they look back on it, I think, is that he did not have the stamina, maybe it was strength, maybe that's an age thing, I don't know, to fight with his own far left.
He needs a sister soldier moment. Exactly. Does she, Kamala Harris, because people are looking at her as the likely person to finish the term.
And they're not going
to
do it.
And she needs to stiff arm the far left.
She can barely manage the script as they write it, let alone have the guts to, you know, or whatever it takes to,
you don't think she can just put on the old prosecutor hat and be kind of law and order in a way that would reassure the middle of the country?
For whatever reason, and I liked her, still like her as a person, but for whatever reason, it's almost like someone who does well in the comedy clubs and then they get on the big stage and they don't do well on the Tonight Show and the career's over. Hmm. Like, she got on the big stage and for some reason, just part of it is the perception and then maybe it fed on itself, but does not look confident. And I just think it's a mental block kind of a thing, because yes, that would be great if she could with confidence go out there. I mean, you know who could do it because he's got that kind of confidence is Gavin Newsom. I don't think he's going to do it, but he could switch on a dime because he's just a great debater who's very confident in what he's saying, no matter what it is.
But he seems...
And he knows his facts.
Because he can tap dance that way, he does seem like he lacks a core of real conviction. I mean, he's a kind of a weather vane in politically. I mean, I
don't see it that way. I see him as way too far ideologically captured by the left.
That's where the wind has been blowing, and he's just stuck.
He's the governor of California. Yeah. I mean, he was out front on, you know, a couple of those issues like gay marriage and stuff when very few people.
Yeah, no, that was courageous and
I think he's shown that. I'm not against a guy who's a great politician. I mean, Clinton was...
Haven't you seen those bad ads, the political ads against Newsom that are just so easily cut by everyone on social media, where they just show him walking and talking about the California way, intercut with just homelessness and tent cities? And whatever's true in California might be beside the point. The optics for the rest of the country is that California is a failed state that's just filled with fentanyl addicts and sex crimes, you know, and drag queen story hour. And you got Gavin presiding over all of it. I don't know how he gets out from under that.
I mean, I thought he would be a great replacement for Biden, as many people did. And I still think he could pull it off. But the polling is very bad on him.
Oh, I haven't seen that. Is it bad?
Yes. Yeah. Somebody sent it to me because I was saying that I think he'd be good. And
it doesn't surprise me.
Yes. And it's basically, it's California. It's what you're exactly talking about. He is tied to this image that we're a hippie commune. We've lost our mind. And, you know, Portland, oh, no, that's Oregon. Yeah. Fuck them.
Close enough. we get tarred with that as well.
Portland's even worse than San Francisco as far as like going. Yeah. Didn't they have the no police zone?
Yeah.
That was a great idea.
Who could have thought that crime might go up when you kick the cops out?
And again, like, I know there are people, and you must know this, that are listening to this right now, like hate listening because they're the two biggest smug assholes in the world are sitting there talking like they know what the fuck is up. And then people on both sides will be thinking that we're that guy.
Yeah.
But
well, we've got a lot to apologize for. Bill Moore. Yeah. I mean, I think the middle, in part, what has happened is that with social media, we have built this hallucination machine where the extremes seem to take up much more of the real bandwidth of the world than in fact they do. And so that, or to represent much more of a public opinion than they do. You've got like 8% on each tail that is just incredibly loud. And you know, some of them have bot armies. Then we've got outside actors like China and Russia stoking, you know, that schism in our society. But the schism is there, but still there's this vast middle of the country that understands that you don't want to be, you know, giving double mastectomies to 12-year-old girls, and that a coup when you're trying to transfer power is not a good thing in America. And they don't want either of those extremes. And they don't want apologies for either of those extremes. Right? I mean, how is it that in the Republican Party, the party line is January 6th was nothing. Like I mean, I understand that there's footage of cops, in many cases, terrified cops, letting people into the building. Because on the other side of the building, people are getting stabbed in the face with flagpoles.
Right.
But how is it that you, however much you want to diminish the significance of the violence on that day, how is it that you can claim that nothing was actually in jeopardy when you have a sitting president trying to ignore the results of an election, and the only bulwark against him really actually trying to hold on to power is Mike Pence and a few other people having their consciences still tethered to the Constitution rather than the personality cult?
Well, I'm going to answer that by saying I was on Megyn Kelly also this week in New York, and I was surprised, and I like her. I think we're friends, and I hope we stay friends. But I was surprised how far right she is. I guess, and when I first came out, she said to me, first thing she said was, I think we're on the scale, not that far apart. You like a 4, I'm a 6. She's not a 6. She's a 9.5 close to Trump. I mean, this is someone who, you know, had more than one fight with Trump.
Yeah. Honestly, I think with her, I don't know her, but I've been on her show a couple of times and I've seen other episodes and I saw your episode. I think this isn't one of those cases where I certainly, my spidey sense is detecting what I'm calling audience capture. She really knows her audience.
Right.
She knows what her audience wants to hear. And I'm not saying that she's just fundamentally dishonest, but it bends her emphasis. And I think to a remarkable degree, she's incredibly fair with people who her audience despises. I mean, much of her audience thinks you and I are just libtard assholes.
She was very, yes, they do.
Yeah.
She was much nicer to me, really, I think, than I was to her. I mean, not that I was mean, but I lost my patience a little because, I think I said to her at one point, you know, the problem is you can't see the difference between an elephant and a mouse. You know, you're hitting me with these whataboutisms, Hunter Biden's laptop and, you know, and it's just not the same. And, you know, I got to say, she not deterred by that. And, you know, we ended it nicely. But here's my question that I think gets to a media question. I said at one point, apropos of your citing there January 6th, what do you do exactly when a mob takes over the United States Capitol, breaking windows, knocking down doors, killing police officers? She said, let me stop you right there. They didn't. No cops were killed. And then, you know, she is a smart person who does her homework and told me why. Okay, this is my problem with the media. Do I believe her, or do I believe, like what I've heard, that there were cops killed?
Well, I think at least one died seemingly as a result of the violence, but didn't die on site.
And look, I have a staff that gets to the bottom of these things for me. But what I'm saying is most people don't have a staff. Without that staff, like doing a deep dive, because I'm not that great a researcher, this question, which until they do this deep dive, I'm going to still have in my head, I always was told and read and thought cops were killed on that day. No, she says, no, that's a misnomer, blah, blah, blah. Everything I read almost everywhere, I only half believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's tedious. It's a tedious way to have to gather information.
Yeah.
And I don't blame people for turning off.
Yeah. Because then what you're left with is each person on their own trying to shore up civilization with their own intuitions about what is real. Like if you're not
yes.
if you're not trusting institutions
right.
to deliver you what they are ostensibly good at, you know, facts about the safety of drugs, facts about the reality of what's happening in a war, I mean, whatever it is, and you're just getting a vibe based on your social media scroll. It's awful.
Describes it perfectly. And that is frightening. And those are the voters. I mean, think about the half that doesn't even vote. They're not getting anything.
A lot of the young who have time to protest or may not in fact be voting. That's why I think Biden's capitulations to the far left have been dumb.
Yes, as I was saying, I really think that's his big failure. Is that, well, two things. One, appointing Merrick Garland. I tore him a new asshole a couple of weeks ago because I think that's a giant failure of the Democrats, is they had 4 years to prosecute Trump. If you're going to go after him, get him. You know, it's the old, if you're going to go after the king, you better kill him.
Yeah.
They have the worst of both worlds. They went after him and didn't get him. That was horrible mistake number one. And number two is, yes, three. Two is this. He definitely caved to the left. I don't think he necessarily agrees with them. He just does not want to fight with AOC. He does not want to fight with that wing of his party.
Yeah, he really should.
And the third thing that I think makes this kind of a failure of an administration is he promised us normality, a return to normality. You won't have to think about Donald Trump every day. Well, it's not normal, but thinking about Donald Trump every day.
What are your expectations for the next handful of months until November? What do you think? I mean, it's an impossible question because anything could happen, but is there, you're just expecting a second Trump term at this point, if you had to bet? Is that what you're...
I would, if I had to bet, yes. I don't think the next few months up to the election, anything terribly violent will happen. I think it's a little like right before World War II, Hitler's taking little pieces of country, but nobody's stopping him and nobody's getting killed.
Yeah.
Because we're not fighting over the Sudetenland. And then the fun will end. I mean, either he will win, which might be the easier way out, because God knows what he and his followers will do. I mean, I don't really mean that. I'm wanting Biden to win and hang on. But if Trump loses, it's going to be ugly. There's going to be people on the streets. It's going to be violent. They're not going to accept it. He's not going to accept it. And this time he has levers of power he didn't the first time. They did learn. Everybody I know about who knows about this tells me the campaign this time is run professionally. It wasn't the other two times. First time, you know, it was just like him and three guys in a basement. Mm. They didn't know what they were doing. It was just, hey, I'm running for president. Let's run that up the flagpole. And God knows, you know, people just flocked to it. So they were shocked. It was a little like the movie The Candidate with Robert Redford. Remember when? Great movie from the 70s, and he wins. And then the last line of the movie, you know, the crowd's out front. They're screaming for him. And he takes his campaign manager in the little room. So they have a moment of silence. And he goes, what do we do now?
Yeah.
Like they had no idea.
It really seemed that they didn't expect to win.
That's what I'm saying. Like they didn't even plan for winning.
Yeah.
Then the second time, he still had a bunch of dundicks in there. But this time they say it's completely different. Well, that's scary. I mean, they've got the uniforms. Now they've got organization. You know, it took him a while to find his Goebbels and his whoever, his henchmen. And so I don't know what's going to happen. But if you're needing a month to be out of the country, I would suggest that one, January 25.
Well, one thing I'm actually out of touch with, I'm sure someone over at the Atlantic or the New York Times has been paying attention, but I haven't seen much press on this. What have we done in the interim in the last 3+ years to get better at running an election such that it will be more provable to the skeptics that it was well run?
Great question. That's a great question, actually, because the last election was, by the estimation of both Homeland Security and the Federal Election Commission, the most efficient, flawless.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even Mitch McConnell said this election was not, by standards, even very close. But yes,
the optics are everything. We have to figure out how to
make it. I don't think there's any way. How could you? I mean,
like the fact that you can just make Alex Jones style crazy allegations based on weird cell phone footage and have that be the thing that drives the story on the far right. You have to hope that people are approaching the actual execution of the counting of ballots this time in a way that is just so transparent that it's just easy to vet, you know, that you're not going to have this.
A certain number of people will never believe anything they don't want to believe. And they don't want to believe Donald Trump could ever lose. They didn't believe it last time. They won't believe it this time. It doesn't even matter to them if it's true. They just want him as president. Yeah. And they think that's more important than democracy. Even Republican senators have said that this is more important than democracy. They don't think democracy is necessarily the most important thing anymore. That's new. But as far as convincing people...
Or they flip it around and say that Biden is the greatest threat to democracy.
Of course. Yes.
That made sense. Yeah.
But the key on the ground, as they would say, is putting Republicans in the counting room who are people of enough integrity so that they will then testify, yes, I was in the room. Because when they count the ballots, there's someone from both parties there. This was litigated in Pennsylvania, one of Trump's crazy lawsuits. It was one of the most comical because they were contending that it wasn't fair because there was none of their team's counters in the room. And the judge said, well, how many of your team's counters were there? And the lawyer for Trump says, it was a non-zero number of counters, a non-zero. He couldn't say, yeah, we had a guy in there. It was non-zero. I mean, it got to that level. So what we need is the John Raffensperger's of the world, those kind of old school Republicans. And that's not an impossible wish because those people do have backbone. They don't control their party anymore, but they're out there. And I think they feel a bit abandoned. They want, like we do, the old school Republican Party back.
Except the fear is they've been purged and many of them have very realistic security concerns.
Correct.
I mean, this is a thing that has not been publicized enough that one of these asymmetries is that on the far right or on the right, you have Republicans, even in Congress, who are afraid to speak sensibly about Trump and Trumpism because they're afraid that their families will be put in peril. By the cult.
Absolutely. Yeah,
that's new. Maybe it was true 50 years ago. You know, maybe 1968 was, I mean, we did have political assassinations were a thing in the 60s. But the idea that political violence is something that our politicians are spending a lot of time thinking about is...
Well, not just thinking about. Yeah. At Biden's State of the Union this year, one of his lines that got one of those half the crowd stands and half just sits there and stares at you was, there is never a place for political violence. And the Republican could not...
Even that's risky to endorse. Oh my God.
Could not get themselves to applaud that. That's what I've been saying with slow-moving coup. Yeah. You could cite these, you know, the wearing of the red ties. You could cite these moments along the road.
Yeah.
You know, when the Congress will not endorse no political violence, we're going to see more of these milestones, and then we're going to get to our destination, which could very well be some sort of civil war.
Why does that sound on its face paranoid? Right. So like, because we look at these historical antecedents, we see that there's a period where somebody like Hitler and the movement behind him, he just looks like a buffoon who's never going to do anything. And
right.
then, but you know, the ratchet keeps turning.
Right.
You get these incremental gains all in the wrong direction. And at a certain point, real people with real reputations are making the sound that Donald Sutherland made at the end of the, you know, invasion of the body snatchers.
Ah!
Right. You know, it's just everyone's been captured and you don't have your the society that you thought you had.
Right.
I mean, when I look at Trump, I've never said I thought Trump was Orange Hitler, right? The saving grace with Trump is that he is so superficial and narcissistic. His concerns are so limited to himself. He's not ideological. He has no big picture aims.
And no plan. And yeah. does not plan. Nothing is planned.
Why he's not nearly as scary as he could be. But the erosion of our democratic norms
Yes.
is still terrifying.
Oh, and he's still terrifying. I was attacked a couple of weeks ago when I said, I think here or maybe on Real Time or maybe both, that I'm not going to lose my nervous system again
yeah.
for a second Trump term, like worrying about it or even if it happens. I did it once and I can't do it again.
Right.
And when he blows up the world, let me know. I mean, I'll do whatever I can to speak out against him. But you're right. He's so unpredictable because it's not driven by anything except his insanity and his sloth. You know, he could easily just sit there for 4 years and eat cheeseburgers and call into Fox and Friends every morning. That could be the whole term. And all this crazy stuff would go on around him. But fundamentally, nothing would change. It's funny, as much as I hate Trump and don't want to see him as president, when someone comes up to me and they go like, Bill, what are we going to do? There's a part of me that kind of resents them just assuming, even though it's true. You know, it's like, how do you know I hate Donald Trump that much? I just want to go, your side sucks too.
Right.
Because, you know, why is he going to get elected again? It's because of woke nonsense.
That's the thing. I blame the Democrats.
Yeah. He is exactly what, that's the talking point that you need to hear on CNN and MSNBC. Instead of just Trump is awful, just delve a little into, yes, he's awful, but how about asking why half the country still prefers it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think this is Douglas Murray's line or some version of his line. I mean, the barbarians will be storming the gates and we'll be asking what pronouns to call them.
Yeah.
You know, that's...
Yeah, you saw those kids who got offered a scholarship by the president of Iran?
No.
Or maybe it's the country. Iran is offering scholarship for any kid who's in a Gaza demonstration who then gets expelled from school. You can transfer to.
It's an Onion article. It's amazing.
Yes. And when you get there, be sure to tell the Ayatollah your pronouns because he wants to be an ally.
There are no gay people in Iran. That's just, we should remember that.
Well, there are, but they're hanging on the end of a crane.
Yeah, there were gay people in Iran.
What do you make of that? The hanging on the crane as a method of, what is that?
Yeah, that's really, I mean, they apparently have a lot of cranes, but they like to make a public spectacle of it. I mean, it's just the dirty little secret of totalitarianism is that it doesn't actually take that many people to cow everybody. Like there are all these scenes where if the crowd had just said, we've had enough of this, they would be able to overrun all the guys with machine guns. You know, there's like 14 people with machine guns and there's 75,000 people standing around terrified.
There's a moment in the movie, The Pianist.
Mm-hmm. I saw it, but I haven't seen it since it came out, so I forgot.
Yeah, well, Adrian Brody and a bunch of Jews are crowded into this square, and then there's probably 1,000 of them, and there's, I don't know, how many Nazi guards around them. And Adrian Brody says to his friend, why do we sit here? There were so many more of us.
Hmm.
If we rushed them, we could definitely, but of course, maybe you're the one who's going to get shot when you do it.
No one wants to be the first.
But it
is a coordination problem, because if everyone went at the same time, I mean, someone would get shot, but you know, not that many. I mean,
we live in such, excuse the term, privileged worlds. Can you imagine riding down, you know, I don't know, Beverly Boulevard, and there's somebody hanging from a crane? Yeah. I mean, we'd be cowed too.
Yeah. It's actually, there was, I'm trying to remember, there was one moment caught on film where the tide did turn, where this was recognized. I think it was a speech by Ceausescu. I think Ceausescu fell at a moment like this where the crowd just decided, no, there's not enough of those guys to keep us scared.
He was shot on Christmas Day.
Yeah, but before that, I think there was a speech that he was giving where he had to just leave the stage because the crowd was about to kill him.
Well, yeah, must have been near Christmas because then they got to him.
Yeah,
but that was a heady time. It's interesting the way the people in colleges now skip over. I've read this. I'm sure colleges vary, but they just skip over the whole chapter of communism. Like among the horrible things that happened, there was colonialism and slavery, and then we go right to Israel. Right. And we skip over the whole totalitarian thing, which probably killed, I mean, between the Soviet Union and Mao's China, probably killed more people than anybody.
Oh, yeah.
And also,
I think it's pushing 100 million people between those two.
Right. Things, yeah. And also, the people who lived were almost the unluckier ones. To live under communism was just a horrible day-to-day existence. The Russian people, I still think, are a shell-shocked people. They are a people who are very cynical, and it's because that doesn't go away in one or two generations. The cynicism distilled in those people from living in a system where, first of all, everybody was watching everybody else.
Oh, yeah. Well, we've built that. I mean, at least on the left, we kind of built that with social media. I mean, just that's what cancellation became. I mean, obviously it's not the gulag, but it's, you know, these reputational murders that we allowed to have happen.
We don't have a red guard per se. We do our rampaging on Twitter.
Yeah. But it has some of the same structure of the full capitulation to fascism or totalitarianism, but it just, it does not run as deep, and I think it's reversible. But you know, you have, like what you were saying earlier, you have everyone essentially declaring epistemological bankruptcy, where it's like, okay, who knows what's true, right? Like, right. Like if you're a government lie, if all you have is state television and you know it's propaganda, what happens is people just check out and they say, well, you know, there's just no way to, it's all conspiracies, it's all lies, let's just unplug, we're just going to, you know, try to eat three meals a day and ignore it. And there's something that there is a version of that that has happened even in the context of our society, where we're still living in a functioning democracy, but the majority of people seem to be siloed in their own information bubble, where they have the news they like, and they're just, but who knows what's real outside of that.
I think this is the one area where you and I sometimes have a little bit of a difference here, because I think in the medical field, this is where this gets kind of gnarly for me, because I just, you know, my philosophy of it, my understanding of it, my personal experience with it is that medicine is the bottom of the ocean. We know some things, we certainly know more than we used to, but we're not living in the future. It really is still, much of it, a giant mystery. Yeah. So when I hear, you know, misinformation about something, or if I hear even, you know, Robert F. Kennedy, let's laugh him off the stage. Well, some things he said, certainly I find laughable. But that doesn't mean that I haven't heard things from Fauci that I find laughable. Just last week, the guy from, where was he? I forget, the NIH somewhere, testified to Congress that, yes, taxpayers did fund the gain-of-function research at the Wuhan lab, even though they had been denying it.
Right.
And he also said, but it was okay because there was no chance anything could go wrong. Well, of course, that's ridiculous. So, you know, there are things that are in the news all the time that make me roll my eyes at the Western medical establishment, or the people who say, especially those people who say, don't ask questions, because it seems like we live by this theory that you can't really give people all the information because it'll scare them and then they won't do what we tell them. You know, there are things maybe that we could be saying about the vaccine, even though we're for it, that would complete the picture more, but we can't do that. because they'll just get scared and they won't do it. And we have to be able to control them and tell them what to do. So I know that some of that in certain circumstances might be necessary, but in general, I want to be able to talk to who I want to talk to, listen to who I want to talk to, read who I want to read, and I'll make my own decisions about what's crazy and what's not. And
yeah, I agree with virtually all of that. I mean, I think you and I will draw the line in slightly different places on specific points, but I just think the one piece in there that I may have a slightly different view on is that a little paternalism is wise, certainly in the midst of an emergency, the scope of which we don't yet understand, right? So with the next pandemic, right, when we don't know how bad it is, and we know we're messaging to a public that is being addled by a crazy president who says that we have 15 cases and it's going to go away magically, right? Like so we have a really polluted information landscape, and it's not clear what's going on, and Italy's falling off a cliff, and New York is creating mobile morgues, and we just don't know. We're waiting for the wave to break.
I get that.
So it's totally understandable that you have, with the best of intentions, people saying, okay, we got a lot of scared children out there. We have to figure out how to make this simple and actionable. And so it becomes a political process in addition to a scientific one. And yeah, it's hard to get right.
And look, we did that. We also fucked
that up too.
But I mean, we froze the world in March of 2020. Froze. We just said, okay, stay home, everyone. Don't move. I mean, it was an eerie feeling like I've never seen in my life. That am I ever going to see my friends again? And it was crazy. Okay, and then slowly we emerged a little because people got hungry and stuff. And then it was just a bunch of hypocrisy about, you know, we're all in it together, except for the people delivering the food to the people who were eating the food. There was two classes of people. Yeah. People who could not in any way be asked to risk themselves out there where the germs are, and the people who were out there constantly where the germs are. So, yeah. But in general, I take your point. Like at the beginning, it was a time that we needed to and did pause.
And I think some version of this applies even to people like ourselves, even in our personal lives. So for instance, this is a point I made elsewhere, I think. I mean, so if I get cancer, when I get cancer, I mean, it certainly seems eventually, if I'm lucky enough to eventually get cancer, I don't die from some other cause, the most rational thing for me to do is to find the best oncologist I can find who he or she has spent their life, you know, for the previous decades, basically focusing on nothing but cancer, right? So they're going to know more than me. They will have read more than me. Even though I have a background in science, it's not going to be wise for me to pretend to be an oncologist, right? So it'll make total sense for me to get a second opinion from another great oncologist. But the truth is, I want to live in a world where I can trust the best specialists on that particular problem I can find. And that's the world I think I still live in most of the time. And so it's not like a blind, bowing before authority.
Can I give you my version of that?
Yeah.
I would also see the best oncologist and more than one, because get a second opinion, which as I've—
Yeah, or a third, or a fourth, whatever
stated,
you want.
Stated many times, that should tell you all you need to know about they don't know much.
Yeah.
You have to get a second opinion, and it's just an opinion. I would also talk to people who weren't oncologists, but I felt they knew what they were talking about, and there are many approaches. I wouldn't if they had cured cancer. You see, if they had figured it out, if I could go into a doctor and have him say, oh, we know exactly what caused this, and we know exactly how to fix it.
But when we cure cancer, that will be how, there'll be the oncologists, plus AI will have cured cancer for us.
But whatever it is, what you're saying is, I would go to these people who are the high priesthood of this, and I'm just saying, okay, they do know a lot about it, but what they really know is how to keep you— they don't cure it, they keep you alive a little longer.
For some cancers, now you can be cured.
Yeah, absolutely.
For others, you're probably being made more miserable than you need to be by the treatment. And it's rational.
But yes, I mean, I'm all for, obviously, in that dire situation, availing myself of the best expertise. I just think the best expertise is perhaps spread out more than you do. You seem to be focusing on just one path, one methodology. And I think I'd just like to hear all the other ones. Now, having said that, Steve Jobs.
Yeah. I think that's the example I'm thinking of.
Yeah, Steve Jobs, I think, said, I'm sorry I fooled around with, you know, eating what, grapefruit or whatever, right, and thinking this would do it. I agree.
Yeah.
You know, he did the wrong, he chose the wrong way. Right. And, you know, we all want to live, and you'll do whatever you have to. I always say, medicine's always playing the odds. You know, there's never any sure answers. You play the odds as best you think they'll work out. And, you know, Western, Eastern, whatever. I'll listen to anybody. I mean, Ross Douthat in the New York Times wrote very eloquently about he got Lyme, terrible Lyme.
Oh, yeah.
And basically the zillion Western doctors he went to didn't fix it. And then he went online and was like, I can't believe I'm entertaining some of these crackpot alternatives, and they work better. So you just never know. And that's a guy who did not want to write that.
Right.
That's just his testimony.
Yeah. Well, no, I think many of us have had this experience that once you're having a medical adventure, you know, either for yourself or someone close to you, it's amazing how frustrating and burdened by uncertainty it can be at every step along the way. I mean, there are very few things for which it's just very straightforward. Like, oh yeah, we have a cure for that. Like,
right.
You're done. You know,
yes.
Problem solved.
That's what I'm always saying about medicine. It's like we're a lot closer to the beginning, in my view, than I think most people think we are. They think, oh my God, look how far we've come. Yes, we've come far, but we really have a lot further to go. I think in 100 years, they'll look back and they're not going to go, boy, in 2024, they had it all figured out except dotting the I's and crossing the T's, huh?
Yeah.
No, they'll be like, I can't believe these people didn't know this and this. I just hope that AI comes to the rescue like within the next 10 years when I probably will need it.
Yes, we hope we're on that rocket. You know, that I mean, this idea of longevity, escape velocity, I mean, the idea that like at a certain point, we will make enough gains in health that if you're alive at that point, we'll be able to keep you around long enough for the next gains,
right,
for the next gains, for the next gains, and you'll just get pulled along with progress. But everyone who missed that first cohort just was unlucky enough to die before their time.
I don't want to be the last guy.
Yeah, the last, the oldest guy to be saved.
Right after you, we cured death.
Yeah.
God damn it.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the decades of life, I heard you were talking to Jerry Seinfeld right here and said that you are actually thinking of no longer doing stand-up.
Yeah.
What's he tell me about that?
Well, I just think to stay youthful of mind and body, you have to like always be doing new things. Not that I don't love stand-up, I do, but I'm going to do a special at the end of the year. It'll be my 13th for HBO.
Mm.
That's a lot. I love it. I think I'm just going to at least take next year off.
Yeah.
See, because, you know, I've done it for 40 years in a row. Sometimes you just don't know if you're in a rut. Even if you like something. Mm. Let me see what I think. You've
never taken a full year off of stand-up?
I've taken a month off.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. No, I'm always on the road every couple of weekends. And so, yeah. And also, you know, the travel. I'm not getting younger. It's a bit of a drag. And yeah, I'm also miss being on stage. And that actual part of it is the joy. But it's a little like playing the cello. I keep saying that's what stand-up is. It's something that you just can't pick up and just do. You have to stay in practice. And it takes a lot of hours and a lot of work. And I already have a job and the podcast. So we'll see. But I definitely am a believer in moving forward and sometimes change just for change's sake. It's so easy to just get into a rut. And so hard to like force yourself to get out of your comfort zone, do this, try this. And when you stop doing that, I think then you're old.
When you look back on your career, maybe take it decade by decade, what advice would you have given yourself in your 30s, 40s, 50s?
Oh, boy.
I mean, did you make consequential mistakes or did you just suffer unnecessarily with stuff that was going to work out anyway and you could have told yourself it was just going to work out?
Well, when I started, I would have told myself, you know, something I probably did tell myself, but I just couldn't conquer, which is don't take it personally when they're not laughing at you. Don't lash back at them. Then they're just going to make it worse. So that's something I did much too much of in the first few years. You know, then finally you get it through your thick skull and you get better. So you're not really facing people who are not reacting the way you would like them to.
So how long was that purgatory where you're actually trying to be a stand-up professionally, or in fact, you are a stand-up professionally, but you're getting punished by an audience that doesn't think you're funny enough?
Well, I mean, of course you're going to really suck the first couple of years.
So really it's years of just a beatdown?
Yeah. Oh, certainly the first year. Yeah. I mean, once you get like 20 minutes of stuff that quote unquote works, you can do a set. That's what you need, 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. I remember vividly when I had that. Let's see, that was like almost 2 years after I started. I remember, okay, I did a 20-minute set and it all worked. Of course, it was Saturday. The crowd was good. It's not going to work that good on a Tuesday, but still, I can survive with this. Like I have a little piece of wood I can get on in mm-hmm. this fucking maelstrom in the ocean. And from then on, it's a little easier. And then, of course, by the time you get to where they know who you are, that's the other big change. When they don't know who you are and you have to introduce yourself first and then make them laugh, you're in comedy clubs, they don't know who they're seeing. They're seeing comedy generically. You wouldn't do that with music. You wouldn't go, hey, let's see music tonight. What kind? Oh, I don't know. It could be polka music and it could be hard rap. You know, I mean, that's ridiculous, but that's what it is for comedy.
I would imagine for a very, very long time, you have only been in front of a crowd who knows who you are. Right?
Yes.
Once you've succeeded, you've crossed over and you're no longer having this cold audience experience.
You're not playing comedy clubs. You're playing to people who bought a ticket with real money to see you in a theater.
It's a very different audience, yeah.
And that's a whole different thing. They want me to be who I am and I want to do it for them so badly. I mean, nothing motivates me more than just loving to give the audience what they want that they feel they can get from me that they can't get from anybody else, because that's what show business is. You have to do something that the audience feels they can't get from anybody else, or else they'd be seeing them.
Right.
So I will miss that, but who knows? We'll see. I'm not making any big announcement about it. I'm just saying I'm toying with the idea.
So in the decades of your career, what stands out is, I mean, I have to imagine the best decades of your life have been like post 50.
I mean, look, for different reasons, obviously. When you're in your 20s and 30s, you're young. I mean, that itself is sort of irreplaceable. It's wonderful part of the journey of life. And you can do things and you have a bon vivant about you that you just, I guess, don't quite have later. But I definitely, because of my personality, the way I am, being a control freak sort of, and also loving adulthood, never liking children or childhood itself. The more adult and successful I became, the more I felt completely comfortable in my skin and not being a young idiot who didn't know how to talk to a girl and, you know, that kind of stuff. Yes, I've really enjoyed post 50, correct.
At what point did your ambition, the results of your career sync up with your ambition enough so that you no longer are feeling ambitious in any kind of neurotic, egocentric? When did you actually settle into the career that felt just rewarding and the plane is cruising at 30,000 feet?
Tuesday.
Next Tuesday.
Well, it kind of has to be next Tuesday. I mean, I'm never satisfied, which is a good way to be. I mean,
is that actually true? I mean, are you?
No. No, I think you've reached different levels. I mean, I think with this book, it's kind of a different level now. I mean, people, something about a book, people take you seriously.
Yeah, that's why you're on this podcast. I wasn't going to have you on without this book.
I would come on with you anytime you wanted me to, but I just feel like it's just another thing. Is it a giant leap forward for mankind? No. Am I in any threat to Taylor Swift for mass popularity? No. But it's a steady climb. That's the thing about comedy versus music. It's much more of a steady climb. There are very few rock star comics, although we've had them.
Yeah.
Dice Clay. Well, and
Chappelle is.
He travels around like that. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. There's been a few, but basically comedy's steady as she goes. You incrementally climb. I'm just glad that I hang on to the audience that's my age and also have a lot of younger ones. And like kids, probably not the average 20-year-old, but there's enough of them. And they're ones who like want to hear the truth about their generation, as opposed to most of them are like, why are you always making fun of us? Well, you do stupid things. You're a bunch of dumb kids, as we all were. And I was too, but I'm going to call it out. And the smart ones in that generation, I feel, are like, oh God, somebody's saying it. Thank you.
Because you and I were never as dumb as the kids protesting at Stanford and Columbia and Yale.
You were probably
last week.
You were probably more mature than I was not a mature person. It took me a long time. I'm a late bloomer.
So do you like your level of, do you have just the right amount of fame, or do you have too much, or too little?
I think it's great.
Yeah. So you wouldn't change parameters of it?
No one wants the paparazzi to be following you.
Right.
No one wants that.
So that's clearly too much. Like, who would you say has too much? Or is just a life negative?
Oh, Britney Spears, you know, P. Diddy.
Taylor Swift.
P. Diddy has had a very bad publicity month. Anybody on that, Taylor Swift, you know, where everything you do is picked over and followed.
I mean, from my point of view, you have too much for what I would want.
Right.
So you're more because you're a television personality, you're getting recognized everywhere. Like, I like being able to assume that in most contexts, most people are not going to recognize me. And the perfect level of fame, I think maybe we even talked about this before, but I've always thought that the perfect level of fame is someone like a writer, like Jean Le Carré or you know, Philip Roth, or somebody who can literally call the president when he wants to, but no one knows what he looks like. That seems a very unique amount of influence.
Well, and maybe I'm more shallow than you.
Being recognized?
Well, it certainly can be a detriment sometimes, as any number of parties that I've, over the years, that I've just left.
Right.
Because somebody just wants to talk to me in a way that, not mean, they just are too excited, and they don't get the, well, I gave you 5 minutes, but I don't know you, and I want to talk to other people. They don't get it. They just keep coming at you. And you just have to leave.
Right.
I mean, that's a small price to pay. But mostly, you know, wherever you go, people will try to like do better for you.
Oh yeah, everyone is super nice. I mean, almost never a negative.
Right.
Approach.
And that, I mean, that's a kind of a great gold card to have.
Yeah.
It's a little like maybe what it was like to live in a small town 100 years ago. Everybody's super friendly and wants to help you. I always feel like I'm living in small town America. And the truth is that people who don't like you almost never come up to you.
Yeah.
It's the people who like you. They just say nice things. And who doesn't like that? I've had the experience more than once of being with somebody, and a stranger will come up and say lovely things. And when the stranger walks away, the person I'm with says, do you hate that? I'm like, do I hate being told I'm awesome? No, I don't hate it. I would hate it if they said you sucked, but that doesn't usually happen. Now, that could change tomorrow. I don't know.
But do you always assume that someone recognizes you?
I never do.
So you're not, but like, so like Tom Cruise knows everyone recognizes
him. Of course.
So everywhere he goes, he doesn't have to think.
Because plenty of people don't recognize me.
Okay. So
plenty.
So you and I, again, you're getting recognized much more than I am, but you and I are kind of in this uncanny valley of fame where it's possible to be ambushed by someone recognizing you. Where it's because the experience I often have is, I'm in a restaurant, you know, talking to the waiter, and we go through the whole meal. And then at the end of the meal, the waiter says, I just want you to know I'm a huge fan of the podcast.
Right.
And I had no idea.
Right.
And then I'm thinking, was I who I wanted to be over this last hour when I now know that my public reputation was on the line with this person?
I would hope that there weren't those two different yous.
Exactly. It was a very, psychologically, it was a very interesting and useful thing to close that gap. Like, just to realize that there's could be a mismatch between who you're content to be when you think you're anonymous and who you feel you need to be when you feel like your public reputation is on the line. It's actually just made me a kinder, more patient person in the world.
What were you doing before?
I was just an asshole.
No, you weren't. It's hard for me to bet. Hey,
I was,
waiter.
I was, Uday
hey,
Hussein. Yeah,
douchebag. Yeah, right, yeah. This iced tea doesn't fill itself.
All right, so who have you most admired in Hollywood? Who are the people in the business who you think just really have done it
Nelson Mandela. Yeah, yeah. And Hillary Clinton. Who, and Jesus.
Well, I guess the other side of that is who...
I don't know. Like, name some people.
Who for whom is there the greatest mismatch between their public persona and who they really are, other than someone like Bill Cosby, where there's quite a gap?
I mean, if you name some people, I'll give you my reactions. I can't think of any great quick answers off the top of my head. Like, who do I admire?
I think I've heard you say that, like, Bill Murray is actually...
Oh. Nobody likes him.
He seems like the most genial guy in the world. That's his shtick, so funny. But he's impossible to work with.
The two stars from SNL's early years, him and Chevy Chase, both have the same reputation.
Is it deserved?
I don't know. Whenever I've met Bill Murray, he's been super nice to me.
Oh, that's because you're famous. He's a star fucker.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. But like I've talked about them too much on this podcast. I'm not going to. But admire, I mean, my world is comedy. So Leno and Seinfeld. Are two people who I don't look up to many people. I look up to you as a clear thinker and one who puts together words off the cuff better than I could. That I don't look up to many people. Leno, Jerry, they're both like such solid human beings, as well as like geniuses at their craft. But like just a great examples because they were a little older than me, you know, in the comedy world. They were like the generation right a little ahead of me. Mm. So,
well, Jerry is really just, I don't know him well. I've just met him a couple of times, but he has distinguished himself in these last six months in being out. Like, unlike all the celebrities I didn't name, he's out there.
And that's not easy for him.
Yeah.
That was what he always avoided more than anything was to be political. Oh, so, I agree.
Johnny Carson, what was.
Well, I mean, Johnny Carson was my hero growing up, and I wanted to be him. And watch The Tonight Show every night from age 12 to 22, I would say. I don't think I ever missed one episode of him. So that's in my blood. I can see it.
Was he just like a shark as a person? Or was
from all accounts, again, very nice to me. But, you know, I saw him for the 10 minutes on the show and sometimes for a minute in the parking lot. I read the book by his longtime friend, Bombastic Bushkin. It rang very true to me. He could be, he was a mean drunk, even by his own admission, and was raised by a mother who gave him no love, would never give it up. And so, you know, cold, there was a coldness to him. And obviously something that was searching and troubled because none of the marriages worked. And he was a complex guy, very smart, genius at what he did.
It's interesting to look back on just the alcohol consumption of that period. I mean, people just were hammered a lot more than we are.
Well, on Mad Men, they find walking into another person's office to be an occasion to pour a drink.
As I've noticed, your podcast has become for many, many people. But
You know, this is supposed to be a party atmosphere with a nighttime feel. I want us to be drinking. But I didn't today.
No.
We did this podcast sober,
for better or worse.
No pot, no liquor.
Well, thank you for everything you're doing. I look up to you as somebody who is fighting the good fight and keeping it funny.
Keeping the barbarians.
The zombie horde.
All sides away. We got to form that phalanx.
Well, it's great to be doing it with you.
You too. I thank you so much for doing this and coming over here from your undisclosed location. And stay safe out there.